Hi, this is Dan Lynch. Join me and Joe Brockmeyer for Floss Weekly, where we're going to be talking to the developer of the Tanika project, all about peer-to-peer communication. That's coming up next on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 298, recorded June 18th, 2014. Tanika. Welcome to Floss Weekly, the show all about free Libre open source software. This week, Randall is away on a cruise. I did actually meet him in London last week for the first time in a while. We met in person, so that was cool. I can confirm he's doing well. He's cruising away there. He's going to be in Liverpool, which is my hometown, tomorrow, so that should be fun. I'm joined by a wonderful co-host, a man I haven't actually spoken to in quite a while, so it's going to be good to talk to him. So Joe Brockmeyer, how are you doing, Joe?
Doing good. Glad to be on again this week.
Yeah, it's fun. I was just saying before the show, I don't think we've actually spoken, you know, other than emails and in text kind of format for maybe 3 or 4 years. So it's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, I think it's been a couple of years. I thought maybe we had run into each other at FOSDEM this year briefly, but maybe not.
It's possible. Yeah. There's so many people at FOSDEM, though. You know, it's kind of hard to remember who you've met and who you haven't in that thing.
The FOSDEM is a funny conference because everybody goes to FOSDEM because everyone's there. So you make plans to talk to people at FOSDEM, and then you see everybody for 5 minutes, and you never actually talk to anybody for any longer than that. So it's the conference where you go and you see everyone, but you don't actually have any useful conversations.
Yeah, the hallway track is hectic at FOSDEM, to say the least. So today's subject, we're going to be talking about peer-to-peer protocols, communication, all that kind of stuff. I'm fascinated to find out more about it. The project's called Tanika. We're going to be talking to the lead developer, who I'll bring on in a second. Have you had any time to look at this at all, Joe?
Not any great detail, no, but this is peer-to-peer is really interesting. So I'm hoping we can get some in-depth description of what the project does during the podcast.
Yeah, and many people obviously worried about, we had the NSA revelations last year, Edward Snowden, all that kind of stuff. A lot of people look into things like mesh networking, peer-to-peer, as some possible way of kind of rooting around, as the internet does, rooting around some of these problems. So let's find out more. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest then. So we're joined by, and I apologize in advance if I get your name wrong, I'll clear that up in a second. We're joined by Petr Maymankov. Is that right?
Got it right. First of all, you got the first name right, which is great.
Good.
And Maymankov is the second one.
Maymankov. Okay. Yeah, that wasn't bad. I was quite close. Considering. So where are you speaking to us from today?
From Brooklyn, New York.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
It's summer weather here in the UK. How are you doing in Brooklyn there? Is it looking good?
It's pretty summery as well, yeah.
Ah, excellent. Okay. Well, it's far too nice to be in a studio, but, you know, we're so dedicated. We're all here working away. So we're going to talk about peer-to-peer communications today. And we're going to talk about Tanika as well. So can you start off by telling us a little bit about Tanika, possibly, and what it is and what the idea is and so on?
Sure. So I was thinking it might actually make sense if I kind of tell you the story. Yeah, sort of chronologically, the way it happened. So in 2001, when I was graduating from college, this was the time when Napster was shut down, and purely because of my sort of desire to have the same thing, I started thinking about, you know, what made it possible to shut it down, and it was quite a prosaic thing. It was simply that a subpoena was sent to a specific address. And so they had to shut down operations sort of indefinitely. The first idea that I had, because I was a computer science student at the time, without I didn't have a pinpointed a passion right this minute. So I started thinking Sorry, I started thinking whether all these sort of cool things that we learn in college could apply to actually remedy the situation with something fun. And after 1 year of essentially working on this problem, and the problem in my head was literally, can we make Napster, but without the dependence on one computer? But can we make it so that all the users are equal citizens in how important they are for the survivability of the system, basically? That was the problem statement. And so a year later, I solved it after I joined sort of this thinking effort. David Mazieres, who happened to be my advisor at NYU, but we finally kind of narrowed in on a simple solution to this, and it had to be an algorithmic solution. Sort of how do you organize an arbitrary churning set of users into a system of knowledge that sort of persists over time, even though the users are churning, and the users are the only substance of the system only when they're online. And so we wrote a paper, and at the time there were a few competing sort of ideas for how to do this. Our paper was called Kademlia, so that's the name of the algorithm that explains how computers should cooperate to kind of maintain some knowledge in an ordered fashion. And eventually it seemed sort of over the years that followed, so 5, 6, 7 years, of the few competing ideas how to do this, the open source community seemed to essentially universally go for our solution because it was simplest to verbalize, but more importantly, simpler to implement in a correct code. Because many of the proposals at the time, especially the ones coming from a sort of the more high-end academic institutions, were very intricate mathematically, and even though in principle they were correct, they were nearly impossible to actually get done properly in practice. So this algorithm eventually, I'd like to think, was the reason why the file sharing world essentially took off, because the crux of it all was how can you store information in a peer-to-peer system, but store it in a way so that it's indexed, such that people who are looking for information can kind of search for things and have some freedom in finding, as opposed to like a previous era, if you will, in peer-to-peer systems where you would just kind of broadcast your question in the void. But you could only reach so many people because you can't flood, 10 million people of a network. So now that you had this sort of more structured network using our algorithm, you started seeing all these open source platforms that were very useful. So you had Overnet and eDonkey were some of the first ones to really take it seriously to implement this indexing sort of logic. And then LimeWire adopted it, and now BitTorrent has it also. And basically any sort of still in use peer-to-peer software uses this algorithm. And I started thinking about what happens next, essentially. Are we happy with the state of affairs? And this thinking, by the way, this is happening 7 years ago. So 7 years ago, the peer-to-peer system industry was booming, so to speak, but also the music industry and the movie industry were being quite unhappy with people essentially sharing this copyrighted material. And so they were spending billions of dollars, actually, literally, attacking all sorts of individuals, sending subpoenas to individual homes, because now it was difficult to send subpoenas to, there was no central server anymore. They were sending subpoenas to homes and to students, sort of presumably hoping to scare them from using these kinds of services and to create some kind of footprint in the media. And they were also, and so this failed as well. So they created some noise in the media, but people didn't seem to really be disturbed by it. And so their final kind of take at how to take down the peer-to-peer systems was to attack the few open source companies that were sort of maintaining the software. But meanwhile, while this is happening, Apple came up with iTunes. And I think this is sort of my interpretation of like the history. But I think that while the music industry was trying to aggressively kind of sue, you know, people out of using peer-to-peer software, Steve Jobs or somebody in Apple was insightful enough to recognize that the format and the dynamic of how you use peer-to-peer software is something that people have created for themselves, so they like the format. But if we wanna, but let's sort of you know, take a little bit of both worlds. So they realize that it's worth it to give up a little bit on the economic side, which is to allow you to buy songs per, you know, single songs as opposed to packaged in an album, which is a financial loss. It's like a clear negative, but it's a tiny negative, as opposed to in return to giving this peer-to-peer looking like, but now legal software. And so this was good enough of a trade-off for the end users that they were, so this sort of constructive move was actually moved most people out of using peer-to-peer software and into using iTunes because it was a reasonable offer, while, you know, the sort of aggressive music industry was simply just trying to sue people left and right. Now, of course, there remained a huge sort of huge networks of people continuing to use peer-to-peer software, because beyond the obvious kind of pleasure of finding all music that you can't even find in a store, there's actually huge amounts of people who have like special interests in all sorts of things, and many of them are quite legal. That sort of harness together enormous amounts of very interesting information, which you cannot find on the internet. And some of it you can't find on the internet for sort of silly reasons, like there are networks out there where people would have movies going back very deep in time. And you can't find them on the internet because somehow they're illegal to be there. But at the same time, they're not provided by any of the commercial sort of suppliers of movies for rent or buy and so forth. So there's enormous amount of knowledge to be had if you ever have the privilege to kind of be invited into these private networks, and you discover that there's, the internet can have very different sort of face and shape and bias and so forth. So I realized then that while iTunes was a decent solution to the, you know, let's share music and, you know, pay a little bit to the artists so that everyone's happy, there still remained a lot more sort of social information that for some reason couldn't be on the web, but at the same time was extremely useful to many people. And so I started thinking about, okay, what are ways to now circumvent even these new methods with which the music industry was pursuing this distributed system? So the method was that they would pretend to try to download a song from the peer-to-peer system, and in the process of downloading, they would see where the song is coming from. So they would see the physical IP address of the person that's delivering the song, and then they would send a subpoena to the physical address corresponding to this IP address. So that was the problem. And myself and the whole sort of academic community at the time was excited about peer-to-peer stuff, so we started thinking quite a bit forward in terms of how can a peer-to-peer system be quote-unquote truly secure for the people who are using it. And it turned out that there are some very interesting, almost philosophical paradoxes if you are asking for something like this. But they were resolved, and essentially this is the interesting sort of story that we kind of get to hear about today. And it's the less known kind of future of the peer-to-peer world where people are sort of trying to converge on, but they don't quite have the language, I find.
Let's put a pin in that for now, because we'll talk about the future of peer-to-peer in a second. But sure. I just wanted to mention the fact, I mean, you've talked so far about music sharing and file sharing and so on, but it's not just that. I mean, the probably the most common example of peer-to-peer software that I know of that everybody kind of uses is what we're talking on right now, which is Skype. So it's not just about that. There's other things you can do. There's telecommunications, sure, and so on.
Right there. No, that's what I said. So the like I said, iTunes settled one of the big users, but they remain quite a lot more. So it continues to be important to actually build peer-to-peer systems that are sort of standardized, so we all know where to go, as opposed to a patchwork of like software from various small makers. And the reasons why we don't have this, by the way, is because if you kind of think about peer-to-peer ideas, they never really have a good business model, because in the nature of software that works on an equal ground with all the other participants, it's very difficult to find a business model, because businesses always have a model because they are somehow privileged in being the, let's say, the provider of the cloud application, because they sit in the center, and peer-to-peer software has kind of essentially repelled capital away from itself because it's just hard to make money, which has resulted in this, in having like a not very healthy open source system of peer-to-peer software. The big story here is that there had to be a new idea, essentially. How should a general purpose peer-to-peer system look, so that it both can be used for any kind of information retrieval needs that people can generically have, as they do on the internet, for instance, on the web. And at the same time, we want each participant in the system to have the kind of privacy and security guarantees that are reasonable to have in life. And so I'll get to, so this is where the crux is, to understand what is reasonable to want as your own security if you are participating in a world of peers, as opposed to a world where a governing authority can ensure any kind of like stated, you know, and state ensured security, right? It's actually the world of reasoning about your security is very different when you are a peer with no governance, as opposed to in a country with governance, metaphorically speaking. The paradox of all this sort of emerged from a paper which was called the Sibyl attack. So this happened, you know, more than 10 years ago. The academic community realized that if you want to have, quite abstractly speaking, if you want to have a community, so the community in our case would be whoever the participants are in some peer-to-peer system, if you want the community to welcome any newcomer from the outside, and at the same time to provide any kind of service guarantees to all the participants, you actually reach a logical impossibility that's physically, just logically impossible. And there's a mathematical proof of this, and one can find it in the so-called paper, the Sibyl attack. But the short story, basically, the short story of the proof is simply that a person or a piece of software can join some cooperative protocol, because all peer-to-peer systems are essentially some cooperative networking protocols where people are expected, software is expected to behave according to the protocol. And so the point is that if the protocol allows for unknown new parties to join in from the outside, what can happen if you are like an adversarial outside party, you can essentially join by creating many kind of tens of thousands or millions of like fake identities, join into this network, whatever it might be, and behave according to its rules for a while. And after you stay in the network for some period of time, if you can just change your behavior radically or just like disappear from the network, thereby destroying a lot of the structure that has been kind of created around you in the network, you're basically killing the entire network. And this can be proven in generality, regardless of what the actual network is, whether it's Tor or something else. So you might take this to be a very sort of pessimistic statement about the state of the world, but it turned out that this pessimism and this kind of lack of bright options only comes because of an oversight in the kind of initial problem statement. So the initial problem statement that people thought describes a peer-to-peer system was this community where people can join in from the outside at will. In this case, you can't have a secure world. But if you try to think about what people, you should be puzzled then, how is it possible that in the non-digital world, people can sort of pre-internet, people can accomplish lots of things that you would currently do with a peer-to-peer system. It would happen much slower, of course, because you have to deal with physical channels of communication and so forth. But people could do, people could get their hands on, you know, questionable information and or like release pamphlets in dictatorial states and still manage to retain their health. And so then you have to kind of start asking yourself, how did they do that? And so, you know, my favorite simple example is, you know, if you imagine that you're trying to be a political, some kind of a rebel in a totalitarian state, and your goal is to distribute a pamphlet which expresses your ideas, but you don't want anyone to know who is the source, because then you would get thrown in jail. And so the way you do it is quite obvious. You would, you know, print the pamphlets. You would give them to, you know, two or three people that you trust, and you would essentially trust their intelligence to do something like this down the line until in this sort of exponential tree-wise fashion, you essentially distribute the pamphlets to the larger audience. But if you think about what it would take for someone to backtrack where what's the origin of the pamphlets, at the very least, you know that they would have to essentially convince your immediate friends, your choices, to betray you. And in choosing your friends, you are essentially engineering your own security. And so what you really want to do is to create a similar an environment where people can do the same thing on the internet. And this is actually something that's doable. And the main difference between this and what we thought was the abstract definition of a peer-to-peer system is that in the real social world, people join into a circle on a given topic through an introduction. In other words, through social links. So it became, long story short, it became immediately clear that any peer-to-peer system that wants to sort of have the ability to guarantee a reasonable sense of security to its users has to have exactly the following sort of high-level structure. To join the network, you have to essentially join your communication channel into the network has to be your friends, which you assign some notion of trust outside of the meaning of the software system. And the point is that you can never communicate with the rest of the system other than by essentially sending information to your friends and having this information be forwarded down the line. The big sort of property of this design is that the only witness of information leaving your hands has to be your immediate friends, people that you have chosen. So this is the property that you have in sort of normal human communication, but you have to kind of say it abstractly to realize what's the essence of security, what's the essential primitive of communication that you need in order to build your own security. And this essential sort of primitive is being able to verify that when you volunteer to externalize information by talking or any other way, that you can verify who are the immediate receivers of this information. So if you're talking to a person face-to-face in a room, within reason, you know that you verify yourself that nobody else knows that this information came from you. And notice that, so this is the only thing people have actually in the non-digital world. And it turns out that this is all you have to give them in the digital world to engineer complex and meaningful sort of security structure, anonymity around themselves, basically. That's the big principle.
Hey, Peter, sorry, can I jump in here?
Sure.
You've kind of covered a lot of ground, and we have a lot of questions about stuff you've covered. So maybe we can work on kind of just answering a question and then let us jump back in, because I have some follow-ups to things you said about 10 minutes ago.
Sure.
So one of the questions I have you were talking, we initially started discussing things like Napster and then into iTunes, and now we're talking about distributing political things in an oppressive regime. Kind of one of the questions that I have is there what people would generally consider a legitimate use for P2P platforms where you're not trying to circumvent copyright or you're not trying to get around the government or something like that? Yeah. Like, is there a use for P2P there that, you know, is just generally useful outside of those parameters?
Yes. So first of all, not only there is actually countless different examples, and I'm going to tell you now about one that I'm pretty sure not many have thought of, just to show you how bizarre these examples can be, but they're very important. So a completely legal, completely sort of reasonable use is the following. Imagine a person who is, somehow a public figure, perhaps a politician, and they have decided that they want to become, as a hobby, let's say, a musician, for example. It's a very sort of very reasonable thing. Now, as a musician, as a rookie musician, they would most likely never dare to share into the communities that would nurture this hobby, like SoundCloud, for example, because this would potentially destroy their political career, right? Now, if they could separate the two identities, the one that wants to publish their sort of attempts at music, and they are very serious and very mature, hopefully, thoughts on political issues at work, They would have it great. They would be able to both be a musician and to do their political work. But because of the prejudice of, and by the way, the reason they can't do it now is purely because of prejudice on the side of the observer. And even though it's not the fault of the politician that they want to be a rookie musician and a politician, it's the prejudice on the other side that basically prevents them from exploring this new side of their personality. But if they lived in a world where there was an internet guaranteeing the anonymity of an identity, so of the publisher of the sounds, of the music, and of the identity of the publisher of the political staff, if they could know that in the digital world these two identities could not be linked, they could explore both of these professions, essentially. And that's a real example, because the fact of the matter is that people who have a footprint on the internet, which now tends to be mostly professionals like ourselves, but the future is for everyone to have this footprint. I mean, in fact, people already kind of have it on Facebook, but it's much more serious for professionals. It turns out that when you start reasoning about your footprint on the internet, you realize that you can't actually say anything that's not completely consistent with a certain kind of very balanced and neutral view on the world, because this is your face and it's kind of out there, unable to speak for itself, but just static. It's out there both to sort of educate people about what you think, but it's also out there to be taken for, by prejudice. And so even just for intellectual sharing of ideas, where you want to impose no prejudice on your listener by not telling them whether you're white or black and so forth, you have to be able to hide your identity every single time you please, if you want to start essentially a new topic of conversation. Because something that's as kind of like prejudice sounds like it's like not a big deal compared to stealing music, but it's actually a humongous deal, because these implicit choices that we make about what not to say compound into basically intellectual blindness, essentially, in society. And so this is the real reason for peer-to-peer assistance. It has nothing to do with illegal things whatsoever.
So basically you're saying, because Obama can't anonymously share his Justin Bieber covers, P2P is one of the things that we need to help solve that.
Precisely, because this trickles, because If you take the Obama example and now flip it around, and instead of Obama, think about some Midwesterner who is like I'm not suggesting Midwesterners have distorted perception of the political world, but pick a person who has a distorted perception, and realize this, that they even if they're curious to like turn on, say, the TV channel of the other side, they might not do it because they're afraid that their buddies would judge them for doing so. And so in preventing themselves from seeing both CNN and the Colbert Report, they essentially preventing themselves from a possibility to glimpse at least into both sides. And so while Obama might not really be interested in being a rookie musician, every single person on the in the audience has some kind of a desire to conform in his group that's preventing them from exploring, essentially learning more. This inability for people to look sort of inexperienced. Remember, this is very psychological and it's very true. When people grow older, one of the reasons why they're like afraid to essentially consider radical changes of their minds is because they're sort of afraid to look beginners while they're exploring the new side. And in being afraid, they're essentially preventing themselves from considering perfectly valid sort of other points of view. And if you give them a digital tool that allows them to live in different worlds safely, you might actually find out that a humongous sort of masses of people that we now think are just whatever the word stupid means, because I'm not sure what it means, it may turn out there are people that are just kind of like implicitly self-restraining themselves from learning more because they don't want to appear strange to their immediate community, basically.
And okay. A lot,
yeah.
Now, before I start on my next question, then I want to turn it over to Dan because I'm sure he's got a couple as well. Tread lightly on the Midwest. I'm calling in from St. Louis.
I love the Midwest. You actually noticed that Midwest is the it was a slip up, but it's only because statistically the Midwest holds the biggest number of people. So by the pigeonhole principle, there has to be at least one person in the Midwest who's like not enlightened. This is all I meant. Okay,
at least one. I think he may be my neighbor. And then so the other question I have for you. So you've kind of talked a little bit about identity, both on anonymity and then also on being able to know who you're connecting with. So I'm kind of curious how those two ideas, you know, you were talking earlier about how you verify that you're connecting with the right person. Right. And then you also kind of talked about the importance of anonymity. So how do we mesh those two ideas in a peer-to-peer system?
Yeah, well, so the big point was to realize the following. So people talk about anonymity a lot on like legitimate like radio state, like, sorry, I mean like on national radio stage, like NPR. And I listen to people and I realize you're going in circles because you never really asked yourself what you mean by anonymity. And actually what people mean implicitly is they just want a complete and absolute guarantee that if they say a certain sort of sentence, it will never be known that they said it. Now, but this is too much to ask for and you'll never get it. So the whole discussion about anonymity is simply to realize that anonymity is essentially nothing more than I'll flip it around and say, so there's two ways to look at anonymity. One is to say that it simply means that you can verify who you are releasing information to. That's one way of saying it. But this way kind of makes it more difficult to see. So what's the big implication? But the other way of seeing it is this. Imagine a sort of a scenario. Imagine that I said something. Let's say we're three friends, friends A, B, and C. So I'm A, and I say something to B that's kind of offensive to C. And I say, B, you know, I think C is very sort of silly, but don't tell them I said this. Now, the thing is, I can never know whether B tells C what I said or not. But what I can know is that C will never have a proof that I said it, even if B goes and says, you know, A said so and so. So the point is that the subtlety here is that information that you say can in fact be leaked past the immediate people you sort of volunteer it to, but what doesn't go past them is the ability to have a proof that you uttered the information that you did. And actually, based on this kind of, and this comes from the fact that you're able to verify that you're, the person you're talking to is the only person. And so actually, I sort of misspoke in the beginning a little bit. The correct statement of sort of the primitive of anonymity is that you are able to verify that the audience that you see is who can sort of hear you the information, and the end part is very important, and nobody else, basically. So in other words, you know who doesn't have the ability to have a proof that you've said something. That's the primitive. You know the set of missing people, essentially. But since it's very big, you know it by kind of verifying who are the present people, by remembering who are the present people, right? So this is implicit in the way we behave, because we never sort of, we get used to it as kids, so you never really think about it. But really, it's verifying who's not there when you volunteer information. That is the primitive with which you build your social security, no pun intended, the security that you have within the organic fiber that you are in society. And that's so anonymity is a relative term which is always only meaningful with respect to sort of other people. Anonymity is basically a way of answering question. If such and such participant of the social system is to try to find out whether I have said something, you know, can they do it or not, given the structure of how I release information in the system and so forth. So anonymity really is just that you can verify the only people who know that, who have a proof that, but it's a proof that only they can use. That's the beauty of it. You see, if I see you say something to me, I know that you said it, even though I can never prove it to other people, but I can use this information at least for my own reasoning about you in the future. So these are proofs that are one time and they belong only to the observer. So that's the thing to realize about anonymity. It's just a system that has one property, that the speaker can verify who's not there. That's it. In the moment of speaking, that's it. Nothing else. Mm. And you can actually have this in the internet, and you know that's what we want to essentially build. Make it simple and standard, and people. Essentially, you want to have a web that has this property, and then people can use it for whatever they want to use the internet. But if it has this property, you know, they would be sort of much richer at what they would do on the internet and so forth.
And we've talked a lot about the kind of obviously the anonymity stuff, the legality and so on, but there's also the technical side of this as well. We've got some questions from IRC coming in. People are discussing it away here in the chat room, and Bruce S is asking about things like upstream and downstream bandwidth, basically. This big world now, we've got huge debates going on about net neutrality and things like that. How can this affect people like, you know, companies like Netflix? We've heard they're looking at things like peer-to-peer. How is it going to affect that sort of thing?
Excellent question. So that's a beautiful question. So here's the answer. So if you imagine that somebody, this is the goal of Tonica, but it's not built yet. But so whoever builds, imagine somebody builds this peer-to-peer system where essentially every person has a piece of software on their computer, and the pieces of software talk to each other, so your software only talks through the internet to your friends. Of course, using an encrypted connection, which you can encrypt because you and your friends know each other and you can agree on a key ahead of time. So this is the network, is this overlay over the internet, which has the social structure physically meaning that your computer refuses to talk to anyone else other than your friends. Okay, so if you have a system like this, and if you use it to essentially route all traffic through it, so meaning that if you want to access Amazon, Amazon essentially, if Amazon were to be part of the system, there would be another node out there. But if Amazon is still on the real internet, you can simulate accessing Amazon by essentially accessing a random other person and then asking them on your behalf to access Amazon. So to sum up, if people were simply just doing all their daily work through this peer-to-peer system, which restricts the communication flows to always be from friend to friend. So there's a lot of traffic, you imagine, that is essentially forwarded through friend-to-friend links. If this is the case, what happens from the point of view of the government and internet providers, basically the people who own the physical wires, what happens from their point of view is that you have essentially your entire sort of all your users. So let's say the best example is you're the government of China, and all the Chinese people are using this imaginary sort of Tonica system for their regular browsing of the internet. So even though the government of China can see that all the traffic exiting the boundary of the country is essentially the Tonica protocol, what the protocol guarantees is that from the outside, you cannot distinguish, you know, one purpose of a connection, one connection from another, which means that you only have two options, either to completely stop the entire internet of the country, which hurts you, or to not stop it at all. But you don't have the option to selectively censor traffic. So that's it. That's the case when you are the government looking from the outside of the system. And remember, even though you own the wires, what we take away from you is the discernibility of what's what. And so you can't just like selectively, you know. Now, if you are, of course, the government is also going to say, but we're going to be part of the system just so we can also listen from the inside. But the beauty of it is that you, that's where the social structure comes in power, is that no matter how many entities you're able to create, fake sort of entities that you would link in this new, system, because the system is based rigidly only flows communication along friend-to-friend links, if you want to like force create a million people, you would basically, first of all, you have to find people that are willing to accept you as a friend. But if you're the Chinese government, surely you're going to find some number of people. You know, these are essentially the people who currently spy on their neighbors, basically, because they do exactly this. They report to the government while lying to their neighbors that they're, you know, they're friends. So these people would give you, you have these in all communist countries. It's like pretty standard. So we know it's a social phenomenon. It's like a real thing. But they're a minority because it's a pretty disgusting way to be. And so what happens is that these people would be presumably presently in the social network. They would allow the government's various fake identities as their friends. But because one way or another, these people, sort of like these people who lie to the work on both sides, because they're a small fraction of society, if the government wants to create a huge number of entities, they would all have to kind of lie behind this small bottleneck. So you can actually create many identities, but they're linked into the real network through a bottleneck. And so what this bottleneck sort of makes happen is that when good people talk to each other in this social network, the paths that they will, the shortest path, or like let's say the natural algorithmic paths that like a good software would find, would never go into a bottleneck, because this is like making your a path longer, essentially. So the idea is that So the Tonica algorithm, really, the substance of it is that essentially there's many, many millions of paths between any two people that might want to communicate in a social network. And the algorithm finds all of them, but it sends information, sort of equal amount of information through all the sort of exponential number of essentially paths in any given sort of social network. But it sends it along a natural sort of graph theoretical force, which is metaphorically similar to the electrical flow. Basically, it literally sends information the way electricity would flow. And electricity has this property that you wouldn't send much electricity through a part of the network that has high impedance, which is the bottlenecks where the bad guys link into the network. And so what this means is that at the end of the day, this means that basically the bad guys, the worst thing they can do is kind of like either alter the traffic that goes through them or drop it. But this is not a concern, because when you communicate with someone, you simply just, you know, authenticate all your traffic. So really the only thing that the bad guys can do is drop traffic. And so how much traffic they can drop is a function of what's the percentage of snitches in society compared to good people. So in other words, you get just a degradation in quality as opposed to total collapse of the system. And the government cannot. And the government also, by the way, just because of for the initial reasons we talked, if you are like publishing information like in a broadcast, like you're publishing some pamphlets, broadcasting it through the system, yes, it can reach to the government nodes, but they can't backtrack where it's coming from. So that's mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't matter basically.
Yeah, so, it makes sense. And I'm afraid we're really, really up against time now because we got another show coming up. But we've got a few minutes left. So very quickly, can you tell us a bit about the state of the system right now? Because I'm just looking, reading stuff about Tanika now. Sure. It's on Google Code, the stuff there. So what's happening? What's happening now?
So here's the short story. I implemented the system prototype. That's what you see there. And it's already, I was implementing it 3-4 years ago and it worked. And then I wanted to make it into a real software, like a user software, for which the only crux that kind of prevents me from doing it, because I also, you know, have a daytime job, but the only component that, like, I really think the peer-to-peer community should solve once for everybody who makes peer-to-peer software, is that there has to be one library that people can use, that essentially gives you something like WebRTC, but not in the browser, but available for software that's like running in the, outside of the browser. Because this is very hard to get right. So the browser, you have like a humongous teams at Google and other companies that make WebRTC happen. It's a complicated thing to do. And so I think the peer-to-peer community should like figure out one way and get it done once so that everyone can reuse this basic connectivity library that just goes through the firewalls and whatnot. Because believe it or not, what prevents the availability of new and interesting peer-to-peer software is this very mundane technical difficulty that from non-browser technologies, we cannot like tackle the problem of, you know, going through firewalls and just like simple non-essential technical issues basically. And so so Tonika would be, I mean, in fact Tonika would be something that if a library like this is available to me, I could make a working prototype much fresher, much newer, probably just in a 2-3 months. But the library is a lot of work, and I think that like the larger community in P2P has to build one for everyone. And I'm happy.
So are,
to, like,
are you the only person working on it right now? Are you the only person working on Tanika,
I'm not even working on it. I'm not even working on it, right, because the software, right, because it like the prototype was good enough. It's clear what needs to be. Basically, just mm-hmm. needs you just need this library that really makes it possible for people that don't have static IPs to use it, and then a little bit of bells and whistles on top, but this is something that's not worth doing before, like, you know, it's putting the cart in front of the horse. I think that we need to first have a reliable peer-to-peer connectivity. Right. That's it. Mm-hmm. And then Tonika will be ready 2 months later. I mean, this is the state of affairs, basically.
Yeah. So yeah. If people want to get, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap any minute now, but if people want to get involved in this and they want to talk about more about this, where's the best place to go to kind of get involved with the peer-to-peer community and start kind of, you know, talking about these issues?
Well, I mean, first of all, if people have questions, what I think is useful to do, they can just email me directly. But I don't. But the peer-to-peer community, which is huge, I don't know of one place where you. I mean, mm-hmm. there's like groups of software developers that have their own ideas, and they form these different communities. So there's no one place where you can go and like speak to everyone, basically, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate. Perhaps it'd be nice if there was an open source foundation specifically for people who do peer-to-peer stuff, so they can all be in one place, as opposed to like duplicate their work over and over and over again.
It does seem to be a perennial problem with a lot of those things. Now I'm gonna ask you. We have our two favorite questions that we always ask on the show that Randall likes to ask. Bear in mind we're gonna have to wrap up in just a minute. I want to ask you. I don't know how relevant this is going to be, but what's your favorite text editor to use for editing code and so on?
Can I give you three, which would be perfect if somehow they could put together? So Acme is the one from Plan 9, Vim and Sublime. So these three can be the least common, they can be put in one and this would be perfect. But I essentially have spent lots of time in all three of them. I use them for different sort of modes of work, basically.
Okay, and do you have a favorite programming language or scripting language or anything like that?
So Go is like the one okay. that currently this language, but I will tell you that Go has opened my mind in a big way, and I realized why I love Go so much. It's because it actually hinted at me an even purer language, but in the same direction. So I've created a new language called Azure, which was going to be released later this year, hopefully soon.
Wow.
And this is the language which I'm going to use for everything, but now I use Go for everything. And Azure is just an even further simplification and distillation of Go, but much, much further. But anyway, so Go is now in practice.
Go is your favorite at the minute.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm really sorry to cut you off, but it's been fantastic talking to you. And if people want to get in touch, your web address is at the bottom of the screen there, or they can look in the show notes get in touch with you through that. Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on, Petar. It's been really good to talk to you, and I'm sorry we have to cut things short, but we've got the clocks pressing against us.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. So that was a very kind of high-level discussion about all kinds of things, and obviously anonymity, all those kind of things. Joe, did you enjoy that? What did you get from that? There was a lot of information in there, I thought.
It left me with a lot to think about, really. I mean, there are a lot of topics. I would have loved to have had another hour to go deeper into just the anonymity versus, you know, who are you issue. But it's really interesting. So I hope we can have him back on sometime or get into P2P a little bit more later.
Yeah, that would be really, really good. I mean, we could have talked all day there, but obviously we have a schedule to keep to, unfortunately. I should probably tell you what's coming up on Floss Weekly. We've got next week, June 25th. We're going to be off that week because the Google I/O conference is on, and Twit's going to be covering that. So make sure you tune in for that. The following week after that, which is July the 2nd, Wednesday, July the 2nd, at our regular time of 8:30 a.m. Leo time on the West Coast there, we've got Turnkey Linux. Jeremy Davis from Turnkey Linux is going to come on and tell us about that, which is going to be really fascinating. And then the following week, July the 9th, we've got our big episode 300 show. And we got some special guests coming on for that. I believe I'm going to be there. I'm certainly scheduled to be there, so that's going to be good. Obviously, Randall will be back for that. And we're going to have a big episode 300 celebration with some special guests as well, which you'll find out more about over time. If you want to find out who's coming up on the show, you can go to our page on the Twit website, twit.tv. Have a look on there. You can find there's a spreadsheet where you can find all the upcoming guests and projects and stuff that we've been talking to and that we're expecting to bring on. So if you want to get a project, there's a project you think you would like to get onto that list. The easiest way to get to the top of the list is have them email Randall. That's Merlin at Stonehenge. I know I got that wrong. Merlin at Stonehenge.com is Randall's address. If you can have someone from the project email them, that's brilliant. They can get talking, get to the top of the list. All right. And so we really, really are running low on time. So, Joe, is there anything you want to tell people about? Where can people find you? Catch up with what you're doing.
So I'm spending most of my time these days on Project Atomic. That's just projectatomic.io. We just released a proof of concept image with Docker 1.0 and new versions of Cockpit and some other good stuff. And so I know everybody is really excited about Docker these days based on Fedora 20. So go ahead and go to projectatomic.io and check it out. And if you have questions or comments, you can find the user forums and all that good stuff on the site.
Very cool. I encourage people to check that out. Lots of interesting stuff happening with Docker right now. If you want to find out what I'm up to, you can head to danlynch.org. And don't forget to check out OggCamp, which is the largest free and open source software event in the UK. We've just announced we're going to be happening in October this year in Oxford in the UK. So all you UK listeners, have a look for OggCamp.org online and check that out. And with that, we really, really are running out of time. So, Joe, thanks very much for coming on and joining me. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem. And that's it for this week. So tune in next time for another Floss Weekly.